From Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. OU anthropologist Misha Klein joins me here in Rio to discuss Brazil's current political and economic challenges.
What they have done is freeze social spending for the next 20 years. It's almost impossible to wrap your mind around what the implications are.
Then we'll hear from University of Pennsylvania political scientist Shervin Malekzadeh, who studies political participation and education in post-revolutionary Iran.
And let's say you were born and raised under the Shah's regime, and now you're under a very different regime. What happens when you have to negotiate between the state, which gives you a curriculum, and the community that you're serving?
We'll also discuss the role of women in the Islamic Republic right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat. Misha Klein, I'm here in Rio de Janeiro with you this week, and it has been an eventful week in Rio. Lots of political happenings. The political leaders seem to keep getting indicted for corruption, more and more charges almost every day. And not only that, they had a new constitutional amendment that was passed this week in the Senate, I believe, to freeze social spending. So tell us what's going on here about a lot of these corruption charges, and particularly what you think might happen now that they can't even spend on their social programs like education, like healthcare.
Well, it's extremely difficult to explain in many ways. To really get a full sense of it, you'd have to go rewind history and take a running start at the whole thing. But what is happening here in Rio is actually layered, because there are things that are happening in the state of Rio de Janeiro, things that are happening in the city of Rio de Janeiro, and things that are happening at the federal level. So what you referred to with the freezing of social spending is certainly the biggest tragedy, and a tragedy that was called out by the UN because of the consequences. And what they have done in this new government is freeze social spending for the next 20 years. So that includes education and it includes health expenditures. And they did it not with a law, but with a constitutional amendment. It's almost impossible to wrap your mind around what the implications are for the general population that is already suffering, that already suffers from not enough spending on education.
So, I mean, obviously, they're already in, as you're suggesting, a financial crisis, and they have been for a number of years. So this is basically just another whammy. I mean, we've had 30 to 40 million people moved up out of poverty in the past many years in Brazil, and now this. So, I mean, how are they going to react to this situation?
I'm not sure that a lot of the people who are going to be most affected by this fully realize what has happened. As you said, the last 15 years or so, there have been several governments that introduced programs that were specifically to address the people in deep poverty. And they did lift something like 40 million people out of deep poverty. And it made a huge difference. That program was already under attack. And then now this constitutional amendment was passed this week by the Senate. That was the final vote. Students have been protesting, and in fact, there have been approximately 1,000 schools across the country that have been occupied by the students as a means of protest. The response of the government to some of these protests has been fairly violent, with some police brutality thrown in. But we still will have to see how this will play out. But it's very, very worrying. And then, as I said, that's happening at the federal level, and many of the people who are in the government who voted on this are caught up in several different corruption scandals themselves, and their solution to the economic crisis brought on by some of these scandals is to take it out of the people who can least afford it. The state of Rio de Janeiro is also broke. That often happens when there are big projects like the Olympics. But in this case, there's more to it that involves scandals. And in fact, in the last month, two former governors were arrested because of two different scandals that they were involved in. So there are evolving scandals at the more local level.
Well, so what we've been talking about this week, Misha, since I've been here, is where's the future leadership in Brazil? Because as you mentioned, lots of scandals, lots of corruption, and then these decisions that are being taken. But where's the new leadership? Are there new and emerging leaders in Brazil that are kind of up and coming that are going to, you know, be able to turn this kind of thing around?
If you're talking about leadership among politicians, there are a few individuals who have been on the national stage for a while. But we'll have to see where this is going to go. It's very hard to anticipate because it's very, very unstable right now.
Well, as always, we'll be watching Brazil and seeing what happens. Thank you so much, Misha, for being with me.
And thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Gorelot. Next, I'll talk with University of Pennsylvania political scientist Shervin Malikzadeh. We'll talk about political participation, education, and women in post-revolutionary Iran. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. My guest today is University of Pennsylvania political scientist Shervin Malikzadeh. He studies political participation and education in post-revolutionary Iran. He's currently working on a pair of book manuscripts about the Islamic Republic. The first studies education after the 1979 revolution, and the other explores the 2009 Green Movement. Shervin Malikzadeh, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Talking about education in Iran, particularly primary education, secondary education, higher education, is something we haven't really covered before. So tell us a little bit about your work and how you became involved in studying education in Iran.
Well, I mean, my involvement, the study of schooling in Iran, begins with me being in a first grade classroom in California and then later in D.C. and born in Iran, but raised in the U.S. since 10 months old. And I'm standing before a class of mostly, I mean, in the case of California, all Latino kids, many of whom are just learning English or their parents don't speak any English at all. So, you know, part of my task is to teach them literacy, obviously. This is a public school, a charter school, but also to make them American citizens. You know, I'm old enough, Gen X guy, to have bridged the sort of traditional narrative, what it means to be American, the sort of stories that we learned growing up, and I think these are very important, these sort of myths, if you want to call them, or if you want to be more cynical, lies that sort of holds a society together. But on the other hand, you know, I've been exposed in college and beyond in terms of revisionist history, who was Columbus, right, and the, sort of the awfulness around his story. So bottom line is, how do I teach six-year-olds about Columbus coming over to the Americas? And I ended up sort of negotiating between the sort of traditional story, you know, we're all Americans, this is what holds us together, and giving them quote-unquote accurate information, quote-unquote, because I didn't go that much into detail into the sort of politics of it. But yeah, so it got me thinking, well, this is in the U.S., and the stakes are relatively low. What's it like in Iran when you have to teach about a revolution? And let's say you were born and raised under the Shah's regime, and now you're under a very different regime, and you manage to keep your job as a first grade teacher. And I have family in Iran who've had this similar scenario. What happens when you have to negotiate between the state, which gives you a curriculum, and the community that you're serving? And I think teachers really have two bosses, right? You know, you have the administration or the sort of state entity, but you have the families who have certain expectations about what they want for their children. So that story for me was very fascinating. And, you know, it gave me an excuse to get money to go back to Iran and hang out with my family and be fed well. So that's the less impressive part of the answer. But yeah, and I ended up hanging out with a lot of Mexicanists, historians who worked on Mexican Revolution. You have a very similar story in Mexico in the early 20th century. So that intellectual framework I then applied to the case of Iran. And it's rarely talked about, which is shocking to me. We think of schooling either as a place where kids go to be brainwashed, to be shaped like putty. And it's surprising to me that people think that. If you've stood in front of 6 or 7 year olds, you know that they have a lot of power, right? But then, at least in the case of Iran, that all changes once the students, especially female students, enter university. Then it's assumed that they become rebels, right? They turn against the state or the system. They're no longer brainwashed. And so trying to reconcile those two sort of conflicting stories has been a lot of my work, I think.
Well, we're going to get to this notion of girls in education in a minute, because your work on that's really interesting. But going back to some of the things that when you're comparing kind of like what's going on here in your experience in the U.S. and then, of course, going back to Iran and studying education there, that you found some similarities. I mean, one of the things you've talked about in your work is education in Iran, the debate about whether it's a public good or a private resource. And we clearly are facing that in the United
Absolutely.
States as well. And in terms of decreased public funding for education, higher education, common education, and you know, passing the burden, if you will, of that support onto families and individuals.
Right.
So did you find some similarities there? And how did the Iranians come down on that in terms of public good versus private resource?
Absolutely. So this is really important point that you're raising. And this is where, you know, I think a lot of us working on Iran are really keen on making Iran ordinary rather than the sort of extraordinary place, a scary place, if you will. And I think the angle on schooling that you just described is a great way of doing that because, you know, the story of education worldwide, modern education, I think, is what was previously a private enterprise, right? People who could afford it or who were blessed enough or smart enough to have access to education in the 18th or 19th or 17th centuries. You know, by the time we get to the end of 19th or early 20th centuries, again, globally, it starts to become the sort of public enterprise, right? We need to make a nation, a state. We need everybody educated, women as well, mothers as well, so that we can prosper as countries. And this is precisely the story of Iran, of course, influenced by the Europeans and then later the Americans. So the project of schooling in Iran, once it becomes a sort of public enterprise, you see a very consistent pattern where the state is trying to get folks to be loyal to the state, to the whatever regime's in charge, as well as skilled, right? So identifying talents and preserving loyalty, I think, is very similar across all societies in terms of the function of schooling. It has a sort of conservative element as well as a very progressive or innovative element in terms of what we teach kids. But what you see in Iran, I think, over 100 years almost at this point, is a consistent pattern where families send their students, their children to school so that they can have good lives. And I think this is very often forgotten. I mean, we take this for granted when we talk about the U.S. context or European context, but when we talk about openly ideological states like Iran, the former Soviet Union, Cuba, we just assume students go there to be brainwashed or, having failed to brainwash or inculcate ideas, to put it more nicely, the students become rebellious, right, dissidents, et cetera. No, families send their kids to school so they can get a good job and get married. I think the evidence is clear, and you interview Iranians, you see this pretty consistently. So I've written a lot about the sort of commodification of schooling and education in Iran, the transformation of what is a state resource back into a private. We've come full circle. Schooling was private for only the select few. It becomes a sort of mass enterprise. And once again, we see it going back private in that, as in the U.S., I think, parents send their students and they're willing to spend tons of money, right? It's a $3 billion industry at this point in Iran. And I think 80-85% of the universities are fee-based, even the state sector ones. And we see a very similar pattern here in the U.S. because the point is, I got to get that paper. You know, this is the peril of the meritocracy, right? I got to get that paper so that my young son or young daughter is established and then can go out into the marriage market, labor market. And in fact, it's a sort of escalating arms race. It's now in Iran, at least, just as here, the bachelor's is no longer sufficient. Now you have to get a master's, right? Then you have to get a PhD, et cetera, or go overseas and study in the case of the Iranian student. So I see incredible similarities. I think it's based on a similar logic of what the purpose of modern schooling is and the sort of relationship it has with specifically the labor market, but I think also marriage market very often. You know, I don't want my daughter to marry an ill-educated guy, whatever that means, right? We have this sort of notion that you're a good person if you've been to university, I guess.
That's Shervin Malikzadeh. He's a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania who's an expert on post-revolutionary Iran. We'll talk more about education in the Islamic Republic right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been talking with Shervin Malikzadeh, a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. When we left off, we were comparing U.S. and Iranian attitudes toward higher education and the value of an advanced degree in the personal and professional marketplace. Well, this is an interesting narrative, and it really resonates with me as an educator, as somebody who works in higher education, has spent my entire adult life in higher education as a student and then as a professor. But, you know, obviously higher education in the United States, and to me personally, was a very important way in which I was able to improve my life. And this is, you know, clearly what we do in the United States. It's becoming more and more difficult because of that private requirement rather than the public resource. But I want to get to your work on women in particular, as you're talking about marriage and marriage prospects. You want your daughter to marry somebody who's educated, so therefore she must be educated. But you've also talked about how participation and education, I would presume, makes you a modern girl, right? And so what is it that you mean by that? And how does girls' education fit into this picture?
That title is a ripoff of Carrie Brownstein's book, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. And this is me being playful with the talk, but really what I'm – the inscription of modernity, the notion that women's role in society, their sort of external features as well as what they do as in terms of their citizenship in Iran is – I think has become the standard benchmark for where Iran stands in terms of what we think of modernity. Of course, that's a big word, right? And we have many notions of what that means. But it's often measured or benchmarked through – the participation or lack of participation of women. It's assumed that if women are becoming modern in Iran, it's in spite of the system. That this is a system that denies modernity to all citizens, but specifically women. And my claim today, and this is a provocative claim, but I think it's perhaps defend, you know, there's empirical evidence for this, that it's through this very system that allows women to achieve certain gains that I, you know, the advancement of individual agency, the capacity to make individual choices, to participate in society in a more full manner, I think is through this seemingly agency denying system. And it's premised on the idea, the logic of the Islamic Republic of needing to demonstrate that it is the path to democracy, the path to a modern or progressive outcome, which sounds weird to our American ears perhaps, right? But within the regime sort of thinking, the state's thinking, this is very much its principle, one of its founding. And this could be cynical, right? Maybe they don't believe any of this, but it's out there. And so therefore, if you're going to have a society, particularly a society that's segregated by gender, you can't have a scenario where women aren't physicians, where women aren't attorneys or participating in the public sector or even the private sector. So what I, you know, the rates of participation for women, and this is where we can again draw parallels to the U.S., are just, they blow the boys away. As we see here in the States, I'm sure you see here at OU, I've seen at the elementary level when I taught, at the university level, women do very well in education and schooling in terms of participation, enthusiasm, and testing, et cetera, however you want to measure it. And it's the boys in many ways who are being left behind. So this has been really a big story in Iran in terms of women's success. Overall, they're 50% of the student population, but at the elite schools, they're well over 50%, approaching, I think, 60, maybe even more than 60%. So the top students in Iran are women. Now, sorry, this is long-winded, but the contradiction here is that the greatest indicator of unemployment is to be a young, educated female in Iran.
Well, so this is what I was going to ask.
So that raises a very interesting question, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And this is the whole point. I mean, I see exactly what you're saying. I've experienced exactly what you're saying.
Right.
But the question is the opportunity post-education, right? Or as one's education continues post-graduation or whatever it is, as you're moving through life, then, you know, do you see in Iran, like we often see in the United States, that then women tend to drop off or drop out or, you know, end up, that pipeline becomes, you know, smaller and smaller as we move up through, whether it's, you know, the ranks in the corporate world or in higher education or wherever you may be. I mean, it's the opportunity that exists afterwards is really in question, is it not?
I think for me personally, the focus on economic outcomes maybe was too narrow a focus for me. To answer your question directly, no, they don't drop out. They double down. We had bottlenecks in Iran at the university, the bachelor's level. Acceptance rates historically in Iran have been about 10%, 13%, 15%. Now it's basically 100%. Still at the elite schools, what would be considered elite in Iran, University of Tehran, for example, it's still about 10% acceptance rate. So going to university is no longer, it's now normal. But the doubling down, by that I mean master's, PhD, they're the bottleneck is very much in effect, 5%, 6%. And what we see are women and men, but mostly women still pursuing that advanced degree. So they're not giving up despite these sort of economic outcomes that we've been talking about. And I'm not sure why. I assume it's because of the sort of sociology of the situation in Iran, that to be a full human, insan kamel, right, in Farsi, to be a good person, you do need to have this sort of education. But if you can't get a job, then why bother? And anecdotally, what you'll hear when you're in Iran is that this is to keep women busy until they get married and settle down and become a mom or whatever. This is all sort of performance. I doubt that young women think that way when they're, you know, sitting down for that high stakes entrance exam for the PhD or whatever they're pursuing. So,
have you explored that though? Do you know what perhaps women are thinking about that?
Then
maybe that's the next.
That's a tough question. Yeah, and I appreciate you asking. I really, it's clear that the economic explanation is not sufficient, right? Because it doesn't logically make sense. Why? I think we could ask the same question here in the States, though, right? Just to be a little mischievous about my answer. I do think that worldwide, but especially in Iran, it's become normal, quote unquote, to be educated. And that definition is expanded increasingly for women from a sixth grade education to high school diploma to university, et cetera. And so what I think is really exciting, the poli-sci part of it for me, is how women appropriating that. There's a scholar, Najma Abadi, who's written about crafting an educated housewife. Originally, women were educated to be good housewives, to stay at home. But they took advantage of that logic, the state, this is early 20th century, to become more educated. You want to have a good citizen or citizenry? Well, then I need to have a high school diploma. Well, I need a university diploma, right? So you keep moving that bar up. And I think the logic of the Islamic Republic also allows for, facilitates the rise of women in terms of educational standards and measurements. But why do they persist if they're not getting a job or if they're not able to get married right away? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that yet.
Well, I imagine I'll look forward to having you back because
okay,
I think this is very interesting information about women in Iran and their educational levels and just education in general in Iran, some interesting comparisons. But I think it'll be interesting to hear what women are thinking as they're moving through the system because we're asking more and more often what women in the U.S. are thinking, for example, about their opportunities going forward. Well, Shervin, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure meeting you and having you share your research with us. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Pennsylvania political scientist Shervin Malikzadeh. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. You can also download all of our past shows and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is produced as a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Brian Hardzinski edits the interviews, Sam Dupre produces the show, and Katie Holland prepares our research. For Misha Klein, I'm Suzette Gorlott.